Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And folks, it is now or never. And we've got a lot of stuff to cover. But and as I told you yesterday, it was yesterday. I'm going to actually convert my, as soon as I've gone through the warfare tactics, I'm going to convert my Monday shows to actually go into a presidential campaign. And I'm going to dedicate, we will have a presidential campaign page on Reclaiming the Republic so that we can spell out very succinctly and concisely every issue. If you want a constitutional president, this is what they will stand up and this is what they will do. And so by actually laying that out, you know, you can make your choice. You can actually vote for the status quo and helping these guys, you know, pad themselves and pad their businesses and, you know, pad their corruption. Or we can finally start cleaning up America. And so, because I've had these epiphanies, and as a matter of fact, we've got Paul Venable. So welcome back, Paul.
Hey, thanks, Pierre.
And so we're going to get into the Massachusetts debates. But one of the things that I think is really, really important is that we really start helping people understand what is it we should really be expecting from our president? Because there's way too many people that have this paradigm that the president, you know, has all of this power and he can do these things. Now, I'm not sure if you heard one of my, I think it was yesterday's show, where I actually kind of exposed this concept that, you know, the president does have an apparatus called the Attorney General. And the Attorney General and the Department of Justice, even though it wasn't constitutionally framed, it could be actually downsized for very specific things. Because as I had the epiphany last week, and I'll just share this with you, as I was actually driving, and I think I sent you a text, which we discussed earlier, while I was actually, okay, after I'd sent that text, because you understand the context was about the presidential nominees and so forth, I go, you know, right there in Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, there is this enforcement of going after people who have failed to fulfill their oath and obligation, that they fail to support the Constitution. So who should enforce this? Because this was, you know, I deal with this all the time. And technically, there's no reason why the Justice Department, if they were actually holding a firm line on the Constitution, they could actually go right into Congress and say, you're gone. Pack your stuff. You're gone. We're notifying the state that you have violated your oath. We're removing you. Because what is the oath of office for the president?
It is to execute the laws of the union.
There you go. And if Section 3 of the 14th Amendment is not a law of the union, I don't know what is. And so it came to me that the Justice Department could have a lot of work on their hands in going through the ranks of Congress and the legitimate, like over in the Department of Defense and so forth, and start actually getting rid of people, because we already know there are certain bastions that are actually unconstitutional, the Department of Energy, Education, and so forth. And I don't think the president should be worried about whether these people are adhering to their constitution, because nothing they're doing, their whole existence, is unconstitutional. And he can't enforce Section 3 in using that to shut down those departments. He actually needs the states to step in and say, you do not have the authority for those departments to exist. So there's, again, I know that the states have a huge responsibility in cleaning up the Republic, but I think that the president actually does have a role to help clean up the corruption, especially those who are functioning within government, because there is a law that says you cannot be a public servant if you're not fulfilling your oath.
That is awesome.
That is. And so that's going to be a part of that. But we can get into that more. But there's just there's a lot of debates to go through, and we need to get through these. We're still, and it'll probably take us at least the rest of the week to get through Massachusetts. And so I really appreciate your help, and I appreciate the fact that you're making the time to do this. And so if we could, are you ready, by the way?
Let's go.
Okay. So,
who is it before you start, who is this Colonel Varnum? We are still in Massachusetts, and
right,
we're about to go over some of his words, but maybe for me and for the audience, Colonel Varnum speaks, and then he's followed by Mr. Choate and General Thompson. Can you help us out with those maybe for a minute or two?
So I don't know Colonel Varnum.
Okay.
And as a matter of fact, I'm not sure, because in some of these debates, I actually highlight how the anti-federalists, so this could actually be an anti-federalist. It's been a little while since I've read these, but because I don't highlight these like I should. I tell people, use green and red. So in this, I have no idea if this is an anti-federalist position, because he's talking about the Bill of Rights and so forth. But
okay.
He's obviously one of those who, and if you really want to know, I mean, you can always Google his name, but, or, use your favorite search engine. But in the very bottom of the debates, it actually shows you where these people were from, if he was from Boston or what county he was from, because they broke down the state by counties for the delegates of, who was representing, this county, who was representing that county and so forth.
Right.
And so anyway, this is on January 23rd. It's a Wednesday, and it is Colonel Varnum who is following up from what Mr. Pierce had said. And really, if we look at what Mr. Pierce talked about, I think he was talking about observation be passed over, I think, the House Sedgwick understood him, that the Constitution consolidated the unions of the states. In other words, it looks like he was making this position that the states were becoming more consolidated instead of the, and what he wanted. So I think Mr. Pierce was an anti-federalist, because the way he actually was speaking, he was not in favor of the way the representation was being done. So, because he was basically recommending that they reduce the amount of time that the Senate would be in office. So, okay. So there we are. Okay. And,
here we go.
Go ahead.
So this is Colonel Farnham, subtitle is Delegated. In answer to an inquiry why a Bill of Rights was not annexed to this Constitution, said that by the Constitution of Massachusetts, the legislature have a right to make all laws not repugnant to the Constitution. Now, said he, if there is such a clause in the Constitution under consideration, then there would be a necessity for a Bill of Rights. In the section under debate, Congress have an expressed power to levy taxes, etc., and to pass laws to carry their requisitions into execution. This, he said, was expressed and required no Bill of Rights. After stating the difference between delegated power and a grant of power, except in certain cases, the colonel proceeded to controvert the idea that this Constitution went to a consolidation of the Union. He said it was only a consolidation of strength, and that it was apparent Congress had no right to alter the internal relations of a state.
There you go. So they can't get into the state knickers. And so we already know that the federal government has no authority whatsoever to establish businesses, to establish the production of commerce, or anything like that. There's nothing in there. The only thing regarding commerce within the Constitution is they are to regulate it among the states. So I just want to reinforce this, because there are people that think we need to, clarify the Commerce Clause. Why? The federal government has no ability to be involved in corporations or anything that the state is doing, other than the fact that the state, it has to be, It has to be organic to the state. In other words, states can't make and allow businesses from a foreign nation to, you know, establish themselves and operate. And why is that? I know you know this, and you'll find it in Article 1, Section 10.
Well, Article 1, Section 10 specifically says no state shall make anything but gold and silver a tender.
That's one of the things, but it's also got the compact clause, where a state cannot create a compact with any foreign entity. So, in other words, they lock the states down to not being able to have business associations with any foreign nation.
So let's make sure we understand this correctly, because we've got foreign companies in states all over the United States.
Oh, absolutely.
One of the things that it points out to me, I think Hobby Lobby was sold to a foreign entity. And so I've been asked this question. So does that mean Hobby Lobby shouldn't be in the United States, or shouldn't be allowed, or that it must be owned by an American?
Either of the above. I mean, it has to be done one way or the other. Get rid of it, or it, you know, in other words, you have to sever the ties of the foreign involvement period. Boom, severed, completely severed. And then, you know, what do we do with the existing brick and mortar Hobby Lobbies? Because they're out there. And so that would either go to, because bottom line, the fact that a business can establish itself in one state and then start doing businesses in other states means that the federal government has stepped in and basically started coordinating and allowing this at a federal level where that power doesn't exist. So this is where the states actually have to, you know, create on their own accord, have to make sure that their own interests are being protected, because this is how states have been hurt economically, because the federal government is allowed to protect the corporations at the state's expense.
So, to make sure that I and the audience understand this correctly, Article 1, Section 10, because it prohibits the states from making compacts with other entities. Uh-huh. In other words, the states are sovereign and independent, but the federal level is a level that deals with foreign entities.
Right. Let's look at this step by step. You want to have a company.
Right.
So what do you do? Under the proper framework of the Constitution, let's just say, you know, we're not going to identify. Well, let's say you're foreign. If you're a foreign person and you come to America and you say, I want to operate this business in this state. So what do you do? How do you operate a business in this state?
Well, if I'm not mistaken, you probably have to have an American partner to do that.
Well, so actually, because you can't create a compact, because if the state can't do it, an individual can't do it. A local government can't do it. So if a foreign entity comes along and says, hey, because bottom line, let's say you're going to start manufacturing and they just want to be able to have the protection over their copyrights. Now, you got to remember the copyrights back in those days weren't honored from one state to another, from one nation to another nation. This is why if you go back, you'll find in the history that there were people that did, you know, corporate espionage and actually stole processes and stole plans and came to America and actually, you know, started manufacturing what they were manufacturing in Britain. And Britain, didn't like
China's
that.
Doing that en masse today.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Now, there are the laws of nations that nation can come up to you and say, hey, you can't do that. Well, actually, you know, the United States could actually say, well, we're not selling this in Britain. We're only, you know, manufacturing and selling it here. And that's what China does. That's what China does.
China manufactures it here, and then they turn around and sell it here.
Well, so I, if that's the case, if they're,
I mean, they can't do it there.
Yeah, they can't do it there. But if they do, if they come in here and start manufacturing it, but that would be a violation of the patent if it's patented or copyrighted. By, like, let's just say HP, if they've actually stole something from HP and they manufactured it here and sold it here, HP would have a leg to stand on to say they're violating our copyright. So,
all right. Now, let me just take this a little bit further, because we have people, I know people who work, I'm from Central Ohio. Marysville has a Honda plant. It's owned by Honda.
Uh-huh.
It employs a lot of people.
Yep. Yep.
I think there's a Toyota plant, a big Toyota plant somewhere in Kentucky.
Yep.
Okay. Hires a lot of people. They build Toyotas and they build Hondas, and it's considered a good thing. And what it sounds like we're saying is that, well, the cars can be built, but not by foreign entities on American soil. That's what it sounds like you're saying.
So, and it, you're right. It can't, in other words, they can't be involved in it. I mean, there can't be any compact or any legal ties whatsoever to that foreign entity. So it's one thing for us to steal the Honda design and actually manufacture it and sell it here.
Right.
But because if you look, where does the Constitution say anything about international patents and copyrights?
No, it doesn't.
It does say that.
Yeah, actually it says something. No, not about international.
There you go. There you go. So it does recognize national patents and copyrights. So how did we get into this concept of international copyrights and international law?
Well, the federal government would have had to stick its finger in this. Here's what I can imagine. We could honor, like, international copyrights of certain countries by treaty. In other words, if we made an agreement, if the federal level made an agreement with Great Britain or France or Japan, is we will honor your copyrights and you will honor ours, and then the states, that would trickle down to the states. The states would then have the authority to honor those copyrights. That doesn't mean that the states can make compacts. The federal government has made that compact. And now the states can honor it.
But the federal government can't make the compact of allowing a foreign entity to come in and operate.
Correct. But okay, we could make a compact to honor their patents.
We could. And actually, so in other words, if we were caught copying and manufacturing, then the federal government basically could come in and say, look, this is a product that is actually being manufactured and you're being challenged on this copyright infringement that we've made because we are trading with Japan. Mm-hmm. And Japan is not, they've gone down this path of not copying our food production and all these other patents and copyrights that we have. Then, they're asking us to protect their copyrights and so that we can have establishing trade. They can enforce the copyright laws,
correct,
but they can't dictate down that the state, has to manufacture, or they can't dictate that these compacts can be created. They have no power to do that.
Okay.
So it's only a matter of saying, well, okay, so if America can't manufacture the car, then Japan has to manufacture it and ship it here, period.
Okay.
Which means that all these automobile manufacturing plants that are being operated by, these international corporations would be, would either turn over to American manufacturing.
Mm-hmm.
Or they would go, they'd get shut down. But the question is, so if you look at how many cars are being built in America,
right?
And that means that those cars are being sold in America.
Correct.
Because we're not building cars anymore. And as a matter of fact, it's gotten to the point in the automobile industry that there's very few cars that are shipped other than the specialty cars. Mm-hmm. And you pay an arm and a leg for that, like a Ferrari. The Ferrari is not built, at least to my knowledge, a Bentley is not built in the United States.
Right.
It is built by the manufacturer. And so, voila. I mean, those are the unique cars that are actually built and shipped worldwide.
Mm-hmm.
And so, bottom line, when we look at, you know, the cars in America that are going to be built, they have to be built by American automobile manufacturers, period.
So here's a question, okay? Here's how I think you could build Toyotas in America. It's American-owned, run by Americans, and we pay them for the patents to use, or this process to use, but it's completely American-owned, and then you can put a Toyota label on.
Yeah, so you, even if it's a franchise, even if we're paying for that, that franchise is a compact. That is a contract.
Okay.
Right?
Okay, so
states are for this, yes. States are prohibited from doing that. And the federal government has no power whatsoever to be involved in the establishment and operations of businesses.
So what you're saying is it can't be done.
It can't be done. In other words, we would have to go back to actually building our own stuff, or we would have to create either an amendment and make the biggest mistake ever and allow the federal government to control us and our manufacturing, which we already know they've gone way beyond telling us how much water we can use to flush our toilets and so sure. forth. Or what can happen is the states can actually create a second polity. In other words, a second general government for the whole purpose. But you would have to still amend the Constitution in changing the involvement of the federal government on foreign trade, because we're talking about manufacturing and shipping overseas or doing deals overseas. Does that make sense? So there still has to be an amendment to the Constitution to do this. And you can create a polity so that the federal government cannot be involved in it, but they still are going to be the financier for it. Because whenever you create a government, you have to have some kind of funding. Well, we've already delegated the power of taxation to the federal government. So what we would do is we would basically dictate this polity to function and do these things, and then it would actually create a very finite budget that they would then pass that budget over to the federal government to collect taxes to pay for this state. Let's call it a state Congress. A state Congress on trade and manufacturing and commerce. So let's say the Department of Commerce becomes a state, but the people that are there do not fall under Congress. These people right here now are actually elected and are appointed by the states themselves. In other words, they are directly accountable to the states. And the strategies that they are executing are designed and are designed to conform to the states and not designed to actually create compromises at our expense. Because the way the federal government operates, they have to give a give and take with foreign entities, which is why we constantly get thrown over the barrel as the United States, because our government is, you know, 9 times out of 10 is more than happy to, you know, assist, you know, these other countries. We can go down with this is a rat hole we're in right now.
Understood. Okay. But I'll tell you what, it's this full compliance with the Constitution is what we need to reclaim the republic,
right?
But it's going to be a hard pill for a lot of people to swallow, because we've gone so far, so long,
yes,
that people are traditionally entrenched.
Right. So the dangerous thing to do, because we're out of time right now. We're going into break. The most dangerous thing, I'll just let you think about this as we go into break. The most dangerous thing that can occur is that the people just start rubber stamping amendments to giving the federal government the current power that it already has to rein tyranny upon us, because that would be the biggest mistake, just to keep everything the way it is. We're better off dealing with the lumps and bumps than allowing this to go forward. We'll be right back after this, folks.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. And so we're back, Paul, and I'll just go back to what I was just saying. If we allow the federal government, let's say we just rubber stamp the federal government to maintain and manage our energy policies, then we'll actually be thrown back and forth by somebody that's willing to subjugate the United States and take away our natural gas stoves and all the rest of the stupid crap that Biden's doing. He should never have that power. He doesn't have that power legitimately. And what he is doing is tyranny. We need the states to actually manage the strategies, because they're accountable to the people directly. The federal government has autonomy. And bottom line, it's hard to get anybody to do anything. And they've already proven that they're a self-licking ice cream cone. They're going to protect themselves. The courts have protected them for centuries. And so we have to break this paradigm. We have to break this situation, this awful situation we're in, where they have been able to list and do to us things that they should never have done if they were serving our best interest.
Right.
So okay. I understand that, you know, it's hard for people to wrap their heads around, but I am telling you, as Milton Friedman stated, the elixir, which is basically the cure, getting the federal government out of our lives in all of these different aspects, that cure may have a change. Your body may go through, you know, what do they call that when an addict, you know, goes through withdrawals?
So we may
go through these withdrawals, but when we come out of that, we're going to be stronger and healthier, and we're going to be able to do things that we never imagined. We're going to have access to all of our minerals, which means that the states that have these minerals will actually be able to thrive, because the federal government right now is not allowing us to do that. We've capped all of our gold mines and most of our silver mines. Why? Because that takes away our wealth as a nation, and we're being set up to become a needy nation instead of the strongest and most wealthy nation in the world, which we are. And everybody knows we have all of the resources, which is why they've already decided who's going to get America. Some people say it's going to be China. That's the globalists. They're already deciding who gets what. Anyway, so I'm sorry. I thought that this was an important rat hole to dive down, because I wanted to get into this as far as the commerce goes. But if you don't mind going back to where we were, because what he said is it was only a consolidation of strength, and that it was apparent Congress had no right to alter the internal relations of a state, which means your business, everything that you're, that's your business.
Right.
Right. Okay.
Right. That's where we left off. And yeah, I agree. It was an important rat hole to go down. So let's continue.
Okay.
The design in amending the Confederation, he said, was to remedy its defects. It was the interest of the whole to confederate against a foreign enemy, and each was bound to exert its utmost ability to oppose that enemy. G, are you getting any feedback from me? Because I'm hearing an echo.
No.
Okay,
good. No, I'm not.
Good. Excellent. I'll continue. But it had been done at our expense in a great measure, and there was no way to provide for a remedy because Congress had not the power to call forth the resources of every state, nor to coerce delinquent states. But under the proposed government, those states which will not comply with equal requisitions will be coerced. And this, he said, is a glorious provision. In the late war, said the colonel, the states of New Hampshire and Massachusetts for 2 or 3 years had in the field half the Continental Army under George Washington. Who paid those troops? The states which raised them were called on to pay them. Now, unless Congress have a power to levy taxes, can they make the states pay their proportion? In order that this and some other states may not again be obliged to pay 8 or 10 times their proportion of the public exigencies, he said, this power is highly necessary to be delegated to the federal head. He showed the necessity of Congress being enabled to prepare against the attacks of a foreign enemy, and he called upon the gentleman from Andover, Mr. Sims, or any other gentleman, to produce an instance where any government consisting of three branches elected by the people and having checks on each other as this has abused the power delegated to them.
Right. Okay. So now that ends the colonel's comment. Now, Mr. Choate, however you pronounce that, steps in go ahead and read his counter comment.
Okay. Mr. Choate said that this clause gives power to Congress to levy duties, excises, imposts, etc., considering the trust delegated to Congress that they are to be to, quote, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, end quote, etc. If this is to be the object of their delegation, the next question is whether they shall not be vested with powers to prosecute it. And this can be no other than an unlimited power of taxation, if that defense requires it. Mr. C contended that it was the power of the people concentrated to a point, that as all power is lodged in them, this power ought to be supreme. He showed the necessity of its being so, not only for our common defense, but for our advantage in settling commercial treaties. Do we wish to make a treaty with any nation of Europe? We are told we have no stability as a nation. As Congress must provide for the common defense, shall they, asked Mr. C, be confined for the impost and excise? They are alone the judges whether 5 or 1% is necessary or convenient. It has been the practice of all nations to anticipate their resources by loans. This will be the case of the United States in war. And he asked, if our resources are competent and well established, and that no doubt remained of them, whether in that case the individuals who have property will not cheerfully offer it for the general defense. After adverting to the idea of some of its being a consolidation of the Union, Mr. Choate concluded by a brief display of the several checks contained and securities for the people to be found in this system.
Okay, so one of the things that kind of comes to me when we read through these things, and they talk about the necessity of the federal government to be able to collect the necessary taxes. So whatever they determined that those taxes are, that they need to be able to collect it. They didn't fathom, when they were up there making these comments, they didn't fathom that the federal government, because the federal government has no power to do anything that they have no power to do.
Right.
They have no power to make highways and waterways and roadways and airports and all of these other things. That is not within the Constitution. As nice as it is that they do it, that is a tax that they're putting upon us that they have no authority to do. And then hand contracts over to unions and actually be able to use the spoils system to basically put money into the pockets of those who were supporting a specific agenda, party, or what have you. You see, the evil, as it comes in with money, the more the federal government can spend money on, the more they can send money in the direction of those who are going to support the direction overall, like the leftists, and move the nation by doing this. So in other words, yes, they have unabashed, unvarnished ability to tax us. They do not have unconstrained powers to be able to spend money on whatever they want to do, which literally stands right out as a huge beacon to all to understand that anything that the federal government is creating as debt, and they are spending more than what they are earning from their taxes that they're collecting from us and taking debt for all these things they have no authority to do, then that debt is fraud. These men didn't fathom that the federal government would become so corrupt that it would be doing these things. They were operating that the federal government would comply, that the states, the deal was that the states were supposed to hold the federal government into check. And so that's why he said, Mr. Choate concluded by a brief display of the several checks contained in the securities for the people to be found in this system. They didn't go on into this. Now, I believe it's a little bit later on where we're actually going to get a citation where a gentleman actually stands up and talks about interposition, that the states have the ability to do this. This is the first time in the ratification debates where we actually hear that the states have the authority, the check, of being able to step in and force the federal government into compliance. But anyway, so I know I'm editorializing, but I want people to understand that, yes, this power was absolutely necessary for taxation to be able to pay the debt, legitimate debt, for legitimate expenses. But when it came down to this, uncontrolled spending and social engineering, things that they had no authority to do, that is fraud, clear and simple. So, anyway, now General Thompson. Go ahead.
General Thompson. Sir, the question is whether Congress shall have power. Some say that if this section was left out, the whole would fall to the ground. I think so, too, as it is all of a piece. We are now fixing a national consolidation. This section, I look upon it, is big with mischiefs. Congress will have power to keep standing armies. The great Mr. Pitts says standing armies are dangerous. Keep your militia in order. We don't want standing armies. The gentleman said, we are a rich state. I say so too. Then why shall we not wait 5 or 6 months and see what our sister states do? We are able to stand our ground against a foreign power. They cannot starve us out. They cannot bring their ships on the land. We are a nation of healthy and strong men. Our land is fertile, and we are increasing in numbers. It is said we owe money. No matter if we do, our safety lies in not paying it. Pay only the interest. Don't let us go too fast. Shall not Massachusetts be a mediator? It is my wish she may be one of the four dissenting states. Then we shall be on our old ground and shall not act unconstitutionally. Some people cry, it will be a great change, but it will be a greater change and be more dangerous to make a new one. Let us amend the old Confederation. Why not give Congress power only to regulate trade? Some say that those we owe will fall upon us, but it is no such thing. The balance of power in the old countries will not permit it. The other nations will protect us. Besides, we are brave and happy people. Let us be cautious how we divide the states. By uniting, we stand. By dividing, we fall. We are in our childhood yet. Don't let us grow too fast, lest we grow out of shape. I have proved that we are a respectable people, in possession of liberty, property, and virtue, and none in a better situation to defend themselves. Why all this racket? Gentlemen say we are undone if we cannot stop up the Thames. But, Mr. President, nations will mind their own interest and not ours. Great Britain has found out the secret to pick the subjects' pockets without their knowing of it. That is the very thing Congress is after. Gentlemen say this section is as clear as the sun and that all power is retained which is not given. But there is the Bill of Rights which shall check the power of this Congress, which shall say, thus far shall ye come and no further. The safety of the people depends on a Bill of Rights. If we build on a sandy foundation, it's likely we shall stand. I apply to the feelings of the convention. There are some parts of this Constitution which I cannot digest. And, sir, shall we swallow a large bone for the sake of a little meat? Some say, swallow the whole now and pick out the bone afterwards. But I say, let us pick off the meat and throw the bone away. This section, sir, takes the purse strings from the people. England has been quoted for their fidelity, but did their Constitution ever give such a power as is contained in this Constitution? Did they ever allow Parliament to vote an army but for 1 year? But here we are giving Congress power to vote an army for 2 years, to tax us without limitation, no one to gainsay them, and no inquiry yearly, as in Britain, therefore, if this Constitution is got down, we shall alter the system entirely and have no checks upon Congress.
So here's an anti—
I'm guessing this guy is an anti-federalist.
Oh, absolutely. And he's doing everything he can to kind of protect. And you can tell that he's talking about Massachusetts. We have all this power. There's no one that could actually come against us here in Massachusetts. And he makes a good point, because if you look at the population and the size of Massachusetts, I mean, so while I look it up, because I can pull it all up here, and so I got to go and find it, but when we look at the population and the land, so in other words, the density of the land, when we look at how many people in Massachusetts by the square mile, and we can actually start, you know, figuring out, wow, Massachusetts has a very good density regarding, you know, the people per square mile compared to Virginia. And so when we look at, you know, these types of things, because I've got it right here now that we've pulled it up. And so when I look at the original order, Massachusetts had, for the size of it, I mean, so what do you think it is? Do you think it's an eighth, a tenth of the size of Virginia?
Probably an eighth, I'm guessing. I'm not looking at the map.
I mean, Massachusetts is pretty small, so I'm going to, because you got to remember, Virginia had Kentucky at that time.
I don't recall that.
Okay, so that's why when we get into the Virginia debates, they talk about the Kentucky counties, because the land of Kentucky was already getting ready to break into a state. They were getting to a point where they're ready to become independent. And they became a state in 1792. So that's how far along Kentucky was. But they were included in the Virginia population, which was almost 700,000. Now, when you look at the size of Massachusetts, they were 378,000. So almost 400,000. So they were more than half the size or population of Virginia. But when you look at the landmass of Kentucky and Virginia, and you compare that little teeny spot of Massachusetts, I'm going to say, realistically, maybe it's 1/30.
Okay.
And if you actually go out and you determine the square miles of both states, Kentucky and Virginia, and then you look at the square miles of, then you'll actually have that true number. I don't know what that is. But my point is this, is that they had such a high population density. At the point in time of the ratification debate, Massachusetts was a superior state in lots of ways. They were doing their own manufacturing, they were growing their own food, and they were so well educated, their life expectancy was up to 70 years old, where most of the other states was much lower than that because of the lack of education. They were learning sanitation and hygiene and those types of things as a part of their education system. They had created a public education system because it was the Puritan church that was doing all this.
Right.
And so the whole point is that when you look at the anti-federalists, I mean, the one place that you would think that the anti-federalists and the cabal would exist would probably be in Massachusetts, and it would be a very strong cabal because Massachusetts was a really, for its size, it was a very strong state. However,
correct.
Because they were so Christian and so righteous as a people, they weren't as corrupt.
Okay.
You got to remember that they were formed because of religious persecution, mm-hmm. and many of the other states were formed for the purpose of commerce.
Sure. So actually, I'm looking, you know, Massachusetts is about a fifth the size of Virginia. This is current. Population density is 78 Virginia versus 256 for Massachusetts. Uh-huh. That's pretty significant, right?
Yep.
And yeah. So that's that. Those are current figures. That's rather interesting.
Okay, so you looked up the square miles of Massachusetts compared to Virginia?
Yeah. Well, actually, the link that I'm looking at is, I think it's out of Great Britain, and so they've got it in square kilometers. But when I interpolate that, you know, Massachusetts is about a quarter the size of Virginia.
Okay, so
in terms of surface area.
Okay, this is a good point to bring in. So the square miles is 93.51 for Massachusetts and mm-hmm. Virginia. Got to remember, you have to add West Virginia, Virginia, and Kentucky. So West Virginia is 24.231. So that's more than twice the size. And then you add, where's Virginia and Kentucky? Folks, I'm sorry, but this actually really helps us put our arms around, you know, the sizes of these states and so forth. So Kentucky is 42,146 and Virginia is 40,411. So that's 82 and adding West Virginia, that basically takes us to 98,000 square miles compared to Massachusetts, which is 93. So it's one-tenth. It was one-tenth the size at that point in time based on population and everything else. So it was more than half the population of Virginia, but it was one-tenth the physical size.
Wow.
So, okay, so it wasn't one-thirtieth, but I knew you had other states there to, you know, like West Virginia, because West Virginia didn't break away until what, the Civil War or something like that around there.
Correct. Yeah, you're I was looking at today's stats. Stats at the time of these debates. Got it.
Right. So you would think, and I'm just editorializing. We talk about the cabals. You would think that the Massachusetts cabal, because here's an anti-federalist that made a point that we're stronger, we're bigger, we're better. Let's be one of the four states that not ratify to keep this from moving forward. In other words, this guy, this general that was making this comment, that was speaking up here, General Thompson, he was actually hoping to not get the Constitution ratified, period.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Sure. If you get four states that choose not to ratify, you would not get the two-thirds.
That's right. You get the nine. Right. So they were hoping that, you know, at least that this constitution, or actually they would have got the nine, but they would, he said the four. I think he probably meant the five, because why even list the four? I mean, you could, if you don't accept it, you're not in it. Why would he say, well, you know, I hope one of the four? I think his position was, and he may be not mathematically accurate, I think he would have been one of the five, but because why would you bring that up other than the fact that you wanted to see the entire thing fail?
Right.
Right. Because, and this is why, if you're actually supporting your cabal, the last thing you want is to have nine states that are operating and creating treaties to actually outbid you and make your life basically unbearable as a state competing in North America against this this group of states that has a consolidated treaty or trade compact, or this, you know, they're able to, you know, do much better deals with other nations than just Massachusetts. So anyway, so the point, getting back to pulling myself out of this rat hole, the whole point here is that here's a man that was really trying to influence the cabal, but they didn't really come close. I think Massachusetts was pretty much well over the line in ratifying the Constitution. It was close, kind of, but, you know, they actually, you know, came to their senses, and the Anti-Federalists really didn't have much of a chance because more of the fact that they were more righteous. When you listen to some of the debates, and we're going to get into them, they're coming up, where we're actually going to hear reverends. Most of the men that were in this debate were reverends, and they saw the righteousness of the Constitution. They made their appeals, and because the people were so religiously attuned as Puritans, they weren't captains or barons of industry. You know, these men were, you know, righteous men, and God first in everything. So anyway.
So they could see, this is important, I think, they could see not only the benefit of the Constitution, in a sense, they could see that the hand of God and his principles in the Constitution. Can I safely say that?
Oh, yeah. And when we get to that, that's exactly what you'll see. That's exactly what you'll see.
All right.
Okay. All right. So let's see here. We've got 1 minute and 12 seconds. So any other points you want to make? One of the things that I'll just point out real quick that you read, it was this one line. Great Britain has found out the secret to pick the subject's pocket without their knowing of it, that is the very thing Congress is after. And one of the things he talked about was a standing army. And he said Parliament didn't have the power to create a standing army for more than a year. But the fact of the matter is the king maintained a standing army because he had his troops and his sheriffs enforcing these laws that was all under the king, in keeping people from being able to go into the forest and shopping, you know, and hunting his pheasants and in hunting his game and so forth. So the king, you know, was very tyrannical because he had the ability to enforce his own laws and execute those laws, where in Congress, this general wasn't pointing out that this odd thing that, oh, you know what? We have to enforce these laws. That's right there in Article 1, Section 8. Why did he not identify that and bring that forward? Other than the fact, and in contrast to England. And so with that, I'm sorry. When we come back tomorrow, I want you to come up with or bring forward anything you have before we move forward. Because we just ran out of time. I apologize for stepping on the last minute here. But anyway, folks, I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
Folks, I'm constantly providing you with case after case and giving you both the empirical information as well as irrefutable academic evidence that the federal government is operating well outside the bounds of the Constitution. In measuring outlays, the federal government is spending over 80% of your tax dollars on unconstitutional government. This is why we don't need a balanced budget amendment. We just need to enforce the Constitution. So what is it going to take for you to take a stand in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution? To be clear, the solution is simple and does not require much work on any one individual, especially if everyone contributed to the effort. We only ask that you make a commitment today to contributing however you can and make the difference necessary for our posterity's sake. Send me an email at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org and let me know how you'd like to help so we can help you save our republic.